BJSF 90.1 in Burnaby, British Columbia.
Welcome to Electronic Intifada Radio. I'm Nora Barrows Friedman. On this episode, U.S.-Israel escalate hybrid war on Iran. Mohamed Mirandi discusses how foreign intelligence agencies are attempting to instigate a mass uprising seeking Iran's overthrow.
This divide and rule is sort of beginning to melt away because people are seeing through the propaganda and the Western Empire is on the decline. If, God forbid, there's a war between Iran and the United States, it will be devastating. But it will be the end, or at least it will bring down the empire much faster than before.
On the Resistance Report, John Elmer tells us about the recently released identity of a resistance fighter behind an iconic battlefield video from Khan Yunis.
So these are sort of missing pieces in the puzzle that we have been putting together of this battle, and it obviously provides a much deeper insight into the fighters that took part who had been anonymous to us up until this point.
And we hear why a popular writers' festival in Australia apologized to Palestinian author Randa Abdel Fattah.
I accept this apology as a vindication of our collective solidarity and mobilization against censorship.
This is Electronic Intifada Radio. I'm Nora Barrows Friedman. This episode highlights the news, interviews, and reports from our live stream broadcast on January 15th, 2026. Later in the show, Dr. Mohamed Mirandi, a political analyst and a professor of comparative literature at the University of Tehran, joins us to discuss Iran's defiance in the face of the U.S. and Israel's regime change efforts. On the Resistance Report with John Elmer, the Qassam Brigades officially releases the names of fallen soldiers for the first time. The squad leader Albara Abu Hatab of the Western Battalion of the Khan Yunis Brigade is revealed as the fighter behind several iconic combat videos. But first, the Electronic Intifada's executive director, Ali Abunima, tells us why 180 speakers withdrew from Adelaide Writers Week.
The 2026 Adelaide Writers Week, one of Australia's most prominent literary festivals, has been cancelled after a fierce backlash over the removal of Palestinian-Australian author Randa Abdel Fattah from its program. Abdel Fattah had been scheduled to speak at the event, which was set to take place from late February to early March. But on the 8th of January, the Adelaide Festival Board rescinded her invitation, claiming her presence might not be, quote, culturally sensitive in the wake of the December 2025 Bondi Beach attack, even while insisting her work bore no link to the violence. The decision was widely condemned as discriminatory and an act of censorship, especially given Abdel Fattah's long history of advocacy for Palestinian rights and her critique of Israeli policy. Many authors saw her exclusion as an attempt to silence critical voices and to capitulate to political pressure rather than to uphold principles of free expression. Within days, a mass boycott erupted. More than 180 authors and speakers, including local and international figures, withdrew from the festival in solidarity with Abdel Fattah, and several board members resigned, including Adelaide Writers Week director Louise Adler, who said she could not be party to silencing writers. Among the prominent figures who withdrew are acclaimed British novelist Zadie Smith, former New Zealand Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern, former Greek finance minister and left-wing politician Yanis Varoufakis, and Russian-American journalist Masha Gessen. With its lineup completely dismantled and its leadership in disarray, the festival organizers announced that the 2026 Adelaide Writers' Week could no longer proceed as planned and was formally cancelled. A newly constituted Adelaide Festival Board has acknowledged the decision to remove Abdel Fattah from the program was wrong. It has issued an unreserved apology and invited her to participate in next year's event. Let's listen to Randa Abdel Fattah reacting to that apology.
This apology as acknowledgement of our right to speak publicly and truthfully about the atrocities that have been committed against the Palestinian people. I accept this apology as a vindication of our collective solidarity and mobilisation against censorship. I accept this unreserved apology as acknowledgement of the harm inflicted on our communities. I will consider the board's invitation to participate in 2027 Adelaide Writers' Week at the appropriate time, but would be there in a heartbeat if Louise Adler was the director again. Whilst the Adelaide Festival statement acknowledges the harm done, it is not a quick fix to repair the damage and injury inflicted. This episode highlights three urgent matters: the profound lack of racial literacy in our public institutions and the need for urgent anti-racism education that is informed by Indigenous perspectives and frameworks. The need for public institutions to have safeguards against political interference by lobbyists, and the imperative of accountability for those who shirk their governance duties in a failure to understand that their duty of care is to their stakeholders and to the community, not groups acting in the interests of external political players. Thank you, everybody, for your support and your unwavering solidarity. We did this together.
I think that this marks a major cultural and political turning point. Israel lobby groups and mainstream politicians sought to exploit and weaponize the horrific Bondi Beach attack to further limit public space for Palestinians and Palestine solidarity, but it spectacularly backfired, and the result of their efforts is a reaffirmation of the right of Palestinians to speak, to be included, and to have a voice. So I thought it was really important to highlight that.
That was the Electronic Intifada's Ali Abunima. You're listening to Electronic Intifada Radio. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. Next, John Elmer reports on the Qassam Brigades, who officially released the names of fallen soldiers for the first time in a series of videos and testimonies dubbed The Moons of the Flood.
This is the resistance report for day 832 of Israel's genocidal war. Today, we are going to go back in time a bit. We're going to go back to the early days of the first battle of Khan Yunis around the end of December 2023, the beginning of January 2024. The ceasefire and prisoner exchange had ended, and Israel didn't want to continue the ceasefire and prisoner exchange because they didn't want that to somehow curtail their genocidal frenzy in Gaza. So they reneged on the extension of the ceasefire in November, and the ground war resumed immediately in northern Gaza and Gaza City and expanded to Khan Yunis in the south several weeks later. I'm going to show a combat video published by the Qassam Brigades in early January 2024 showing a series of operations in Khan Yunis. The fighters are, of course, blurred as they were throughout the war, and we are watching the battle scenes basically through the eyes of the fighters, the cameras on their heads. That's their point of view of the fighters themselves. The operations are, of course, deeply complex, but they are shown, especially early in the war, as a tightly edited sequence of operations. This was a common way that Qassam presented their operations. So let's go to that January 2024 video now. We have seen various different ones, especially later in the war. We saw more of the complex detail in the operations, but early in the battle, this is how the first videos were released. And this was the first one from Khan Yunis, and it's an iconic series of operations we just saw there, a fighter emerging from a tunnel to hit a tank that's basically within spitting distance of the Qassam tunnel. Now we're watching a series of Yassin strikes versus armored vehicles. And it's just one after another, one event after another. Again, we don't see the fighters, you see their hands because you're essentially looking at it as if you're, I mean, their cameras are on their foreheads, so you're seeing it really right through their eyes. There's another tunnel operation against a Puma engineering vehicle. This one here, the fighters sneak up there and attach a guerrilla action device underneath the turret of that Israeli tank in Khan Yunis, and the tank explodes. Around that time, the Israelis acknowledged a number of deaths in an incident similar to that. Unclear if it was exactly that one, but a guerrilla action device placed in the turret, and that is a Yasin strike on a Puma engineering vehicle that's carrying a demining rocket launcher set. And here's the captured equipment from the Israeli soldiers. So again, not a lot of detail, one after another, tight edit, and that's what we know of those operations at the time. This was a single video published by Qassam, and often on the resistance report, I parsed out these videos, individual operations, so that we could break down as each individual operation rather than the way Qassam presented them one after another. But we know now that this was the Western Battalion of the Khan Yunis Brigade, because this week the Qassam Brigades for the first time began recognizing the names of their soldiers that were killed in the Battle of Al-Aqsa Flood. Their policy during the war was not naming their fighters officially out of operational security, but also out of safety for their families, something that I think in retrospect seems perfectly reasonable considering the massacre of civilians that defined Israel's what they called the Iron Swords operation. There was two exceptions to this. The Qassam Brigades acknowledged the commander of the middle camps, Ayman Nofal, was killed, and the Northern Division commander, Ahmed Gandour, were killed early in the war, and Qassam acknowledged both of them. But no fighters were acknowledged. And so what we're going to see on the show today is the first look at the first soldiers in the first time that we have seen the faces of the fighters that are behind the videos. The first soldier that they acknowledged was Albara Abdul Karim Abu Hatab. And this is how they've been releasing them. It's called the Moons of the Flood. And this is one of the first of six fighters that they introduced. Albara Abdul Karim Abu Hatab was a squad leader in the Qassam Brigade's Western Battalion in the Khan Yunis Brigade. And it has been revealed here for the first time that the name of the Western Battalion is the Hudayfa ibn al-Yaman Battalion, which is another nod to the Battle of Uhud and the mountain of archers that have been weaved through Qassam's messaging for these past 2 years. Hudayfa ibn al-Yamam was a companion of the Prophet who remained on the Mount of Archers and did not retreat, and was a soldier and a commander throughout many key battles in early Islam, and also known for his operational security and secrecy. So again, really strong messaging by the Qassam Brigades in the few ways that they have to do it. Albara Abu Hatab, it says here, was born January 1991 and died in battle in February 2024, which is about midway through the first battle of Khan Yunis that ran from late December to early April. People may remember it ended in Khan Yunis. The first battle of Khan Yunis ended with the Night of Power during Ramadan, a detailed operation that drove Israeli soldiers from Khan Yunis the first time. And Abu Hatab was 33 years old when he was killed. His final testament was one of the first of the six that were released by the Qassam Brigades this week under the banner of the Moons of the Flood, as in the Battle of Al-Aqsa Flood. The testaments are recorded before the battle, and this is a standard thing for resistance fighters to do, for operatives as well. Sometimes they take simple photographs. For example, during the Second Intifada, these martyr posters were the centerpiece of the wall coverings all over the West Bank and Gaza. But sometimes the fighters record longer messages, as is the case in the Moons of the Flood series. So let's watch Abu Hatab's testament and that martyr video that was published just this week. The music is a resistance song saluting the martyrs, describing their place in the national project and on the road to Al-Quds. Albara Abu Hatab is a squad commander, so in charge of a group of somewhere between 7 and 14 fighters. And they've shown him for the first time here. They're showing him in photos here, addressing his troops. In training here, we can see him training with his troops. This is something that we have seen. It's common for martyrs to have videos like this. During the war, operational secrecy prevailed, but after the war, they salute their martyrs. And that is him there giving his testament. And his testament is deeply thought out. It's poetic. He weaves the scripture through a poetic prose. But he's addressing in his testament, addressing his troops. He addresses two people principally. First, his people, the Palestinians, who have suffered throughout this war and for decades before. And he says that your blood is precious. Your cries of pain and suffering is foremost in the fighter's consciousness. As other fighters have said, the people are the jewels in the crown of the nation. Remain steadfast and patient, he says, because the dawn of victory will emerge. He then addresses his fellow fighters, calling them knights, and he said, who stood tall with unceasing determination and unwavering resolve that displays your dignity and which does not and will not disappear or set like the sun. Persist in your quest, even if the goal seems distant. And he repeats that the emerging of the dawn of victory is near. And here we see battle footage. Here we see him in battle. Normally, when the Qassam videos came out, this would be blurred. We would just see their hands. But for Al-Bara, we see all the detail here of him wiring up a television anti-personnel IED and concealing it here. Usually, we would see this in their videos, at least briefly, but we see it here in long form, which is something that we haven't seen before. As he's wiring up these IEDs, he's talking about how the prisoners will be freed and that the usurping enemy will be returned to Gaza in boxes. We see him here now in a tunnel, and he's addressing his squad. He says, "Praise be to God who made us fighters and guardians of this land." You can see over his shoulder there the Yassin 105 and his fighters with their blurred faces. Potentially, they have survived, and that's one of the reasons why the blurring continues. He tells the fighters, in effect, that your brothers before you have fulfilled their promise and remained steadfast, and now this is our duty too. And he comes up here. You see him through the tunnel on the way to this operation that we saw at the beginning of this segment. You can see him here, and he says that today is the day of revenge, and it is victory or martyrdom as he moves up the tunnel and out onto the battlefield. You can see them here. This is a battle by a greenhouse against Israeli troops. There you see the archer who launched from the tunnel at those two Israeli vehicles was Al-Bara. He is the man behind the videos in both of those. So that voice that you heard was Al-Bara, and you can hear him saluting Salah Aruri. He salutes Sheikh Salah. This operation took place in western Khan Yunis just a few days after the assassination of Salah Aruri in Beirut. And so that's Al-Bara himself. That's the voice that we heard. And it's his voice saluting Sheikh Salah for that operation and saying, may he rest in peace. So these are sort of missing pieces in the puzzle that we have been putting together of this battle. And it obviously provides a much deeper insight into the fighters that took part who had been anonymous to us up until this point. Of course, that is part of the resistance strategy. And you can see it prominently displayed in Abu Obeidah. It's the opposite of a cult of personality, but each individual representing the nation in the battle. And this week's release is just the first of the fallen Palestinian resistance fighters. It's only the beginning. I suspect we'll be getting these for quite some time, and I will continue to follow these and put these pieces together as we did on this show today for Al-Bara Abu Hatab. So this has been the resistance report for day 832 of Israel's genocidal war on Gaza.
That was the Electronic Intifada's John Elmer. You're listening to Electronic Intifada Radio with me, Nora Barrows-Friedman. In cities across Iran, millions of people have marched in support of their government and to protest violence that foreign intelligence agencies have been instigating in the latest Western push for regime change. Israel's Mossad spying and assassination agency has actually been boasting publicly about its role. On January 14th, enormous crowds turned out again in the capital, Tehran, for a mass funeral of some 100 police and security officers killed in attacks by foreign-backed insurgents. Western media and politicians paint a totally opposite picture, portraying a regime in crisis, wantonly killing its own people to crush a mass uprising, seeking its overthrow. And while Western governments pretend to be concerned for Iran's people, they continue to aid and abet Israel's ongoing genocide in Gaza. For more, the Electronic Intifada's Executive Director, Ali Abu Nima, and I join Dr. Mohammed Marandi. He's a professor of comparative literature at the University of Tehran and a renowned geopolitical analyst. Dr. Marandi, thank you for joining us again on Electronic Intifada Radio.
Thank you very much for having me. It's always an honor.
I want to start by reading you the opening paragraphs of a story that appeared in the New York Times. The headline is "Shoot to Kill: Accounts of Brutal Crackdown Emerge from Iran." And the subheadline is "As many as 3,000 feared dead as witnesses describe government forces firing on unarmed protesters." Here's how that story begins. As the Iranian authorities impose a near-total communication blackout on a country convulsed by mass protests, eyewitnesses say government forces have begun opening fire, apparently with automatic weapons, and at times seemingly indiscriminately on unarmed protesters. Hospital workers say protesters had been coming in with pellet injuries, but now arrive with gunshot wounds and skull fractures. One doctor called it a mass casualty situation. Despite the communications blockade, a recurring image has made its way out of Iran: rows and rows of body bags. In videos uploaded by opposition activists on social media, families can be seen sobbing as they huddle together over bloodied corpses in unzipped bags. And in footage aired on Iranian state television, a morgue official, sheathed in blue scrubs, stands amid bags neatly arranged on the floor of a white room under glaring fluorescent lights. And I'm skipping a bit now, but just a few more sentences from this New York Times article. They say, "The toll of dead and injured across the country is unclear. Human rights groups are struggling to reach their contacts inside Iran and follow the methodology they normally use to verify information, but say they have counted more than 500 dead. Multiple American officials say that U.S. intelligence agencies have conservatively estimated that more than 600 protesters have been killed so far. The agencies have noted that both the current protests and the crackdown are far more violent than those in 2022 or other recent uprisings against the government." A senior Iranian health ministry official, speaking on condition of anonymity, said about 3,000 people had been killed across the country, but sought to shift the blame to quote-unquote terrorists fomenting unrest. The figure included hundreds of security officers, he said. So, Dr. Marandi, that's an excerpt from the New York Times, but it is typical of coverage across Western media. And now we're even seeing claims from CBS, the American news network run by Israel propagandist Barry Weiss, that the death toll may be higher than 12,000. We're also seeing countless statements from Western governments condemning Iran in the strongest terms and threatening even more sanctions. This is the picture that is being uniformly presented of the situation in Iran as the media talk about possible U.S. military intervention. What's your response to all this, and how do you see the situation in and from Tehran?
The New York Times, first of all, or Reuters in particular, because Reuters began this whole thing about anonymous Iranian officials gave these numbers of deaths. Reuters has a history of lying. Whenever they have unnamed officials, they're lying. And I have personal experience because during the nuclear negotiations, Reuters was constantly quoting officials and saying things that were not true because I knew they were not true because I was involved. I was the media advisor to the team. What I can say, Ali, is that I was on Piers Morgan yesterday, and it's a very bizarre show. I only went because George Galloway said you should go, so I went. But on the show, I gave them footage to show. I said, I want you to show this footage. And it was helicopter footage of Monday's mass rallies in support of the state, in support of the Constitution, in support of the leader, and against the riots. And it was across the country. Every city had its own. And the one in Tehran was massive. And Pierce brought this crazy woman who threatened to kill me and cut my body into small pieces. Anyway, he brought her and she was saying, this is fake. And Piers Morgan wanted to say, this is fake. So this is AI and all these millions of people on the streets across the country in Iran, they're AI.
You attended or you witnessed those rallies on Monday yourself in Tehran?
Yes, yes, I was there. In fact, I entered, for those who may know a thing or two about Tehran, or they could use AI, I entered from Hafez Street and I went to the Vali Asr crossing, and I couldn't go further because I was stuck and I got worried that it was just too big of a crowd. And it went all the way to Imam Hussein Square. And my relatives near Azadi Square said the crowd went there. And a couple of friends of mine from, I know you don't know these names, but from Enghilab Square south to Imam Khomeini Square, he was on that route and it was full. So the east-west street, I guess, is 10 kilometers because it has bridges and undergrounds. And then the north-south, I don't know how many kilometers it is, full of people. And when I was leaving, when it was over, people were still trying to get there because they were stuck in traffic. I took hours to get there and to get back. What happened, Ali? Let me put it this way. The first day, we had a sudden fall in the currency. And that was because the Americans were manipulating the markets from abroad in neighboring countries. And that's why people think that this was all a part of the plan. After the currency fell, shop owners and business people, like a few thousand, a couple, you know, here and there in different cities, combined a few thousand, went to the streets and protested to the central bank for good reason, because they were saying, we sell our goods and then the goods that we have to buy with the profit are now more expensive and we can't do it and we'll go bankrupt. There are no arrests. There is no police brutality like you see in Germany when someone is wearing a keffiyeh. There are no policemen battering people or taking them to jail because they had a placard, like an 80-year-old Jewish woman in London saying no to genocide, and she has to go to jail. Nothing happened. And then on day three, these rioters came in. Now, Pompeo, the former head of the CIA, said that in his tweet that Mossad is on the ground.
Just to put that, to give people exactly what that was, this was on January 2nd. Former U.S. Secretary of State and CIA Director Mike Pompeo tweeted, quote, "Happy New Year to every Iranian in the streets, also to every Mossad agent walking beside them."
They're not even trying to hide it anymore, really.
No. Yeah. This is all about Palestine. I mean, the authoritarian regimes that the West talked to, though all the authoritarian regimes that have no elections are U.S. allies. But Iran, which has elections, which has, you know, the one day they're saying this is a reformist president, the next day the other, you know, so there's diversity in Iran. But Iran is evil and sinister because it opposes the genocide. So Pompeo says that Mossad is there. The Mossad says that they are there because they put out a Persian language statement. And I think the Jerusalem Post also said something about this, saying that they're on the ground. And then I think just yesterday, Channel 14 of Israel, the Israeli regime, said that foreign countries are giving weapons. Now, they are saying it. And then Western pundits are saying, no. No, they're all peaceful protesters. So the guilty party is saying, I did it. And then their entourage is saying, no, they're not doing it. It's all peaceful protests. In fact, I read this person, I don't want to name him. He did a tweet and was saying what Channel 14 of Israel, when they admitted that foreign governments were sending in weapons, what Channel 14 is doing is it's undermining the sort of peaceful protest narrative. Well, yeah, of course, because there were peaceful protests and nothing happened to them. Then the rioters came in. And then, Ali, we had 100 officers of the law, roughly, who were murdered. 300 to 400 with the Basij, with the riot police, and with the guards, let's say, all of them. 300 or so. Some say up to 400. Some say, no, it's closer to 300. In the United States, a woman is driving her car. She's turning to the right. She gets shot in the face. And then the argument is, and the divide in the United States is, whether she turned enough to the right to make the shot in the face unacceptable, or whether she didn't turn enough to the right and she deserved to get shot in the face. So when this is the debate in the United States and the U.S. president is supporting the ICE officer who murdered her and shot her three times, then the United States and the elites in the United States are in no position to talk about rioters who killed 300 to 400, but let's say